There's lots of very innovative research going on relating to alternative energy sources. And certainly there's a lot going on at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, as I mentioned just a minute ago, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, for example, and the Wisconsin Energy Institute are doing a lot of great works. And sometimes we get updates on familiar topics, and other times, like today, we hear about concepts that are probably new to, certainly new to me, maybe new to you as well. And a couple of guests. Tom Johns is the Granger Professor of Power Electronics and Electrical Machines at UW-Madison. He is actively involved in renewable energy research in the areas of wind power generation and electrical microgrids for sustainable buildings. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Really great to have you with us today. Also with us today, Bob Lassiter. Bob's an emeritus professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. He directs the Power Systems Engineering Research Center, which is a multi-university center focused on restructuring of the electric power industry. Man, that sounds like a big job. Bob, thanks for spending time with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with a description. Anna, by the way, before I even start that, let me invite you to join in. Have you heard of microgrids before? How committed are you to using renewable energy? Would you pay extra or sacrifice some convenience if necessary? I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. So let's start with the description of an electrical grid. How does it harness or store or deliver energy? Who wants to start with that? Tom, you want to?
Sure, be glad to at least kick things off. What we're here to at least focus on a bit is a little bit different from perhaps what typically might be a topic of conversation about either only photovoltaic or only wind. Here we're addressing the issue of if you have those kinds of resources as they become available, how do you connect those together? How do they interact with each other? How do they interact with the electric grid that all of us tend to just take for granted? And it becomes particularly an issue when you start talking about having a photovoltaic array on every rooftop. And we refer to that as distributed resources, taking what otherwise we're in our usual life would think of as a big coal-powered plant or a big nuclear plant, and instead breaking it up into a lot of little pieces in which we have a separate grid on every rooftop or a wind turbine or perhaps a small generator set. Point is that leads to some significant changes in the way that the electric system is put together, and that's something that has to be worked on in addition to working on photovoltaics by themselves. It's the issue of how you put these pieces together.
Yeah, so that's a microgrid.
That's not what we're talking about, is leading up to a microgrid.
And so, and certainly then that relates to renewable energy. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, aren't we?
It's renewable energy is part of it, but it's only a part of it. And in fact, Bob here deserves to have an opportunity. In fact, maybe when it comes to actually defining a microgrid, he's one of the pioneers in this field, so he really deserves an opportunity to jump in at this stage.
Bob, how'd you get started in this, by the way?
Oh, this goes back 12, 13 years.
Ah.
It turns out in the past that small generation was coming online, really before PV, which were cost-effective. And then the issue becomes, how do you make them useful? And one way to look at it, let's say we decide to put some PV in this building, or we could put some generation that would run off of natural gas and give us heat and cooling and electricity. But what happens if the utility goes down on us? We go down too. Our PV doesn't work.
Photovoltaics is
what
you're
saying. Sorry. Yes, solar energy.
Yeah.
Won't operate anymore. The generator you have will shut off, and that's for reasons of the utility, but also technical reasons. And so the microgrid world will say, hey, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Why are we doing this? Why can't I keep my energy even if the utility goes away? And so what we did was figure out how to make this building disconnect rapidly.
Ah.
And how do we keep these things operating? And when the utility is back in a normal state, how do we reconnect to them? And so a microgrid is like some generation, some load that disconnects and reconnects to the utility. And it really brings a lot of value added.
Oh, I would think.
Now, an interesting story is Sandy. And we have a microgrid there in Manhattan that we were involved with. And this is a 20-story cooperative apartments. And they have, like, I think 4 or 5 machines that's providing them heat, power, and some air conditioning. And when Sandy hit and Manhattan went out, this building kept functioning.
Oh.
And it functioned for the 4 days, and the population went from its normal residents of 740 to maybe 1,400, which was probably every friend and relative and anybody that was nearby.
And here we are talking about it just as we approach the anniversary of when that storm came through just about a year ago.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we were hearing tragic stories about hospitals that lost their power and had to evacuate all of their patients under very difficult conditions. So that whole storm, which was, of course, a horribly tragic event when it comes to this technology, demonstrated both some of the positives as well as what can happen when things don't work as planned based on the conventional technology.
So how difficult is it to be able to connect and disconnect? I mean, that's got to be not an easy job.
Well, the connect and disconnect is not too difficult.
Well, disconnect probably isn't too hard.
Yeah, or reconnect. The problem is when you disconnect, you don't have the utility to stabilize your building's voltage and frequency. So your local generation has to have the ability to replace the utility and stabilizing everything in fractions of a second.
Ah.
And that's where all the technology is, and the work over the last 10 years has been directed in that way.
Carl in Madison has a comment. Carl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello. Thank you for the program. I just, I'm not any kind of expert on microgrids, but it does strike me that not only does it allow us to access a wide variety of new energy sources without having to have one dominant large system, but also protects us from potential threats from abroad. We hear all the time about the vulnerability of our electrical grid to the internet and all of that. And it just feels to me that the work these gentlemen are doing in this area and not only that, but also climate change, where we may have storms or damage in one area of the country, breaking the grid down into smaller pieces and allowing people to have a variety of ways to produce energy to add to it just sounds like a really great idea.
Oh. Thanks for calling. Tom, John, a comment?
Well, I mean, you're doing a great job of explaining some of the things that we hope to eventually get to when it comes to talking about the different aspects. I mean, this is a concept that the more you dig into it, you realize that there's a variety of different aspects. Like any technology, it has its advantages and limitations. But when it comes to some of the advantages, you've just noted one that is taking on increased importance by the day, and for very good reasons, that there is concern about having a utility that can be vulnerable to, having some significant damage, either through, direct terrorist activity of the type that we perhaps might imagine, but also now more and more cyber attacks, things that are more insidious, but nevertheless can be very destructive. So to the extent that we can break the utility system up, I'm oversimplifying, into a bunch of little pieces, each of which can operate as its own little grid, its own microgrid, you at least have the opportunity of making the system, we would use the term, more robust against external threats that might otherwise do more damage if it could shut down at one fell swoop a large swath, a whole city. Instead, we're talking about a whole range of smaller microgrids that operate to a large degree. They work cooperatively, but ultimately they can operate independently when they need to.
Carl, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, that's a great way to. I mean, this all sounds great in theory, and I guess it's working in practice, at least in some areas, Bob.
Oh yeah, we've had a lot of really practical applications, and probably our The one we're the most proud of is a jail called Santa Rita Jail, just outside of San Francisco, which has really been involved in being green for a long time. Like, so they have a fuel cell there of about 100 megawatts, and they have PV on all the cell blocks of over another 100 megawatts. But the problem for them was these systems tripped off when the utility had problems. And so with the help of the Department of Energy and the California Energy Commission, they decided to put in a large battery that would provide microgrid capabilities. And that was commissioned a year ago, and it's very, very successful. It has had really no problems at all. And so that was a large battery and a switch to switch off. So when the switch opened up, the battery kept voltage and frequency stable. So the PV energy could be used and the fuel cell energy could be used in a very effective manner.
Oh, man. We're going to be talking to Tony and Hebron. We'll get to you in just a couple of minutes here. Our guests today talking with us about microgrids, building better links between renewable energy and the electric grid. Tom Johns, Granger Professor of Power Electronics and Electrical Machines at UW-Madison, and Bob Lassiter, who is an Emeritus Professor of Electrical and Commuter Engineering at UW and also Site Director of the Power Systems Energy Engineering Research Center. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the IdeasNet. Wisconsin is an innovator in many areas, and alternative energy certainly no exception. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Always happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network, and we're always happy to get an update on what we're working on over at the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center and at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Bob Lassiter, one of my guests today, is Emeritus Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at UW-Madison. He was the former site director of the Power Systems Engineering Research Center. And that's a multi-university center focused on restructuring the electric power industry. And Bob, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Tom Johns is the Granger Professor of Power Electronics and Electrical Machines at UW-Madison. He is actively involved in renewable energy research in the areas of wind power generators and electrical microgrids for sustainable buildings. And Tom, thanks for being with us as well. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much. My pleasure.
You can join in as well. Have you heard of microgrids before? How committed are you to using renewable energy? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you as we talk with our two guests about microgrids, that really building better links between renewable energy and our electric grid out there. And microgrids, again, this is, you can think of microgrids as maybe being one building.
It very well could be, mm-hmm. and that's perhaps a convenient way to think of it in terms of kind of under grasping the concept.
Or does it have to be just one building?
No, and that's one of the attractive aspects of microgrids is that it is a flexible concept that can apply to one building, could apply to several buildings, a block, or there's even opportunities to apply it to large industrial facilities. And I think we're still learning the limits of where it makes sense and how big or how small is the most economical and practical. But we're learning, and there's already a lot of progress that's been made in terms of appreciating how the system works and how it can be put together in a way that's practical and economical.
Yeah. And we're really working with solar and
yes.
Wind,
mm-hmm.
Probably those are the two main.
Well, thank you for bringing that up because, I mean, I'm personally very interested in renewable energy, but it should also be kept in mind that this concept also can incorporate other technologies based on, I'll use the term more conventional technologies, say
sure.
a diesel genset or these days perhaps more likely a natural gas genset based on an internal combustion engine, which is not a new idea, but the idea of integrating that into a system of this sort. And one topic that hasn't come up, adding some energy storage, because we all know the sun goes up, the sun goes down, winds blow and winds don't blow, and we expect our lights to go on anytime we flip the switch.
Yeah.
And so issues of energy storage enter into the picture, too, in terms of filling in the valleys and providing a constant power, regardless of whether it's day or night or whatever the weather conditions are.
So how good a job are we doing now with, I think we've made some big improvements in terms of sort of capturing that energy through like solar energy, for example, compared to even 10 years ago.
Oh, it's a lot of progress has been made. And one of the most exciting aspects is simply the fact that the cost has been coming down. And and it's not just simply a matter of saying, well, we'll make more of them and they'll be less expensive. I mean, there have been very significant advances in the technology that continue as we speak. And frankly, that is one of the biggest barriers. I mean, there's several barriers, but one of them, undoubtedly, is simply the cost of the technology. And so, progress in the last 5 years has really been, even for experts in the field, has caught a lot of people, experts, by surprise at how steeply the rates are coming down. And so, it's changing the ball game in terms of at least opening opportunities for economical installations that just weren't practical even a couple years ago.
Yeah. Especially, Bob, I would think for businesses, perhaps this would be...
It makes some sense, but let me add to what Tom has just said. There are parts of the country where solar becomes practical is how much does it cost to put you in and how much do you have to pay for it?
Yeah.
So you can go down to the Southwest and find out, hey, it's a no-brainer to put it in, while upper Minnesota, it may be too costly.
Yeah.
And so that's playing into the economical part of it. Now, one of the technical problems with solar is what to do when it's not available.
Yeah.
A cloud comes over, a storm comes on, it's at night. And the logical solution is storage.
Yeah.
But storage is too costly to really be practical now. And so what we're finding is we'll mix solar in a building with some natural gas generation and use its waste heat. And so you then end up with a really economical combination to make that fly and really make sense today.
So waste heat is a big deal.
Number one, yeah.
That's an important point to bring out that hasn't really clearly come up in the conversation. But the point is, if you have a generator set that uses an internal combustion engine, I mean, anybody who's driven a car knows that there's a lot of heat that comes off of the engine. And in fact, it's really shocking, I think, for a lot of people to realize that it's really only about a third of the energy that's in the gasoline eventually gets converted. All the rest goes out as waste heat. And the same happens if you're using an engine like that for turning a generator in a genset. So why waste that heat when we have water in the house that we want to heat up? We have people living in the building that need to be heated, certainly in Wisconsin winters. And by using that, I mean, it's really incredible how much of an impact that can have in raising the overall energy efficiency inside a building. I mean, there's numbers that are verified that bring that level of energy efficiency up from numbers that are well below 50% to numbers in 75% or more. And so it's not just a little tweak. We're talking about a very significant change. And that's why, a lot of us are very excited about what the so-called combined heat and power, often referred to by people working in the field as CHP, why that concept is attracting so much attention.
Ah. And we have lots of callers who have questions for and comments, so I want to give them a chance to join in. Tony in Hebron, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. There's so many moving parts to this conversation. I don't know which one to comment on. But the one I heard most recently through reliable sources is that utilities are starting to lay the infrastructure to start sending out power in the direct current versus alternating current form so that they can accept microgrids without rectification. Have the panelists heard anything about this? And if so, how far are we away from that coming to being?
Go ahead, Bob Lesseter.
I haven't heard of this recently. I mean, a good 20 years ago, there was a lot of research in building DC transmission, as they'd call it. In other words, our DC distribution. In other words, the local electricity would be direct current based. But we've kind of moved away from that. And one of the issues is we say, well, solar puts out DC voltage, or batteries are DC. And you start thinking about all these new technologies that are DC-based. Why turn them into alternating current, which we use right now? And one of the problems is it becomes very difficult to control DC. When you put multiple sources together, unfortunately, you got to put some things that control the current flow. And so it's not an obvious solution over an AC solution. But there's a lot of research and a lot of debate on this right now.
Yeah.
Could I?
Yeah, go ahead, Tom. Add something.
This is actually, you can go all the way back to Edison and Tesla to get into debates between DC, which is, as Bob mentioned, is the kind of power that you would have from, say, from a battery or from a solar cell. Compared to the AC, which is, as the name implies, it's alternating current that changes its directions at a 60 times per second. The issue of which is best is, of course, one of those questions that depends on how you define best. And so there is some very active research underway right now that is trying to make best use of DC where it makes sense, but then combine it with the conventional AC, which is the way that our electric power is distributed, and try to create the most economical, reliable system that's possible. So it is an area of active research that's going on here at UW as well at a lot of different places around the world to try to explore that and to try to find the best solution. So not an easy question to answer as far as a simple, what's best, but it is moving forward, and I think it is going to be part of the long-term solution.
Ah. Thanks, Tony.
Is there any loss of efficiency when a person generates their own power, whether it be wind or solar, through the rectification process, or is that just a zero net sum gain? And there's no loss, but is there a loss from the power you generate to the power you can actually utilize when you rectify the circuit?
What the question is asking is has to do when you go from one form, from DC, or in this case from AC into DC or back and forth, you go through some electronics, which in the process has some losses associated with it. And I'm afraid the simple answer to the question is that there is no simple answer. It really depends on the circumstances. As you transmit power over long distances, it goes through transmission lines, and those transmission lines create some losses of their own.
Yeah.
And so you're trading off those losses against some losses that you would have in your own electronic box in your own house. And so that is part of the ongoing engineering debate and discussion as far as what's best. And there certainly are cases where performing that conversion locally would be the more economical solution. And so that is certainly part of what's one of the aspects that's driving the technology, driving some researchers and engineers to seriously consider that approach.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tony, for calling. I appreciate it. Tom in Prairie du Chien. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, this is quite interesting. I live on a small dead-end road with 8 houses, and this might work for us potentially. I'm curious, you've described in your examples of the microgrid what sounds like single meter. Can you combine meters on a neighborhood in a certain region and so on and install your controls you've designed upstream, and then we would go form a small co-op and build our own power source? Would that be practical, or are you envisioning something like that?
Again, you're doing a great job of telling our story for us because the issue of having what's often referred to as community power, which community could be a neighborhood of homes that are geographically close to each other but nevertheless cover a certain area, say a block or whatever the area might be, that is, again, a significant opportunity, and some companies are taking a look at that very seriously, not only companies in terms of industry companies, but the utilities in terms of assessing whether that kind of approach makes sense and whether it's economical. So it's, again, comes back to the same kinds of questions that, that have to be answered as far as whether it's right in a given area. But by bringing up the case of areas that have are far separated from where the electrical power is being generated, it's like being out at the end of a long limb of a tree that, you know, that gets kind of wobbly.
Yep.
And so the idea of having some a microgrid at the end of that long branch that can provide some additional stability is a very viable approach. And in fact, I'll take it a step further, and this is where I think Bob will have something to say, is if you talk about truly remote areas, I mean, third world locations where there is no central power plant, there the opportunity to combine the same kind of ingredients we're talking about, solar power, wind power, natural gas genset or whatever the local energy that's available, and have that operate as a miniature grid, a microgrid that then can supply that small community with just the light bulbs and maybe a little refrigeration. I mean, it's life-changing for in those circumstances.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
And Bob has had the opportunity to be working some with the World Bank in terms of looking at potential opportunities, which are just endless. And so it's really a continuum, everything from a neighborhood in a city like Madison here all the way out to a small community that might be in Africa or some other developing part of the world. It's really exciting to see this technology expand in several different dimensions.
Man, is it ever.
You know, that's an enormous topic. But first, look, there are some existing standalone microgrids right now, like Tom was talking about. But in this case, it's in the middle of Manhattan.
Yeah.
It turns out there's a dock in Manhattan that the utility can't get the energy to it. It would cost too much to put the cables in. So they now have a microgrid that runs 24/7 on that. And it uses the waste heat and it uses natural gas. And it was the low-cost solution in Manhattan. Now, obviously, that can translate into remote villages or into your situation with 8 homes. But there's a lot of technical issues that have to be addressed to make it robust and low cost. And that's sort of what we're dealing with now.
That's what you're researching now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about your research.
Well, we're very fortunate to have a new building that's gone up on campus here. It's actually an organization and a building called the Wisconsin Energy Institute that was mentioned earlier. When that building was built, we were fortunate to be involved in designing some new laboratory space in there that will give us an opportunity, specifically in custom design, to be compatible with different types of renewable alternative energy as well as with some of the conventional types. And the goal is to use that as a facility to make it as easy as possible from a research standpoint to be able to interconnect these different types of energy sources, but also different types of energy storage, and to look at not only how each one of these sources behaves by itself, but focus on how they interact with each other.
Yeah.
Often that doesn't receive attention, and then frankly, that is becoming part of the major new frontier in terms of rather than looking at only a solar panel, instead expanding that to look at, hey, what happens if we combine that solar panel with a natural gas generator, with a battery bank. And sometimes the surprises are good. Sometimes the surprises aren't so good in terms of what we find. And so we refer to this as a system approach to the concept, and that becomes more and more important as the technology gradually matures.
You know, Connie in Cuba City emailed us, and just to go along with that, she wonders, will we see wind turbines that can also be solar collectors? If the wind is not blowing, the sun's shining.
Well, that issue of how to combine different types of renewable energies as well as conventional energies is a major, major topic. And very important, is receiving a lot of serious attention to try to figure out how to combine these in the best way so that when one source isn't available, either because the sun has gone down or whatever, that another source would be available to take its place. And in some parts of the country, that actually works out quite well, where the typical patterns are for the winds to be stronger at night and suns to be of course, available. available during the daytime. Other parts of the country aren't quite so lucky and need different mixes. But it's there has been a lot of progress made in terms of being able to, first of all, understand it, but also, dare I use the term, predict the weather in terms of knowing what the conditions are going to be on a given day at a given location. And that becomes a critical part of the story if we're talking about higher penetrations, a higher more renewable energy compared to other sources. And then it becomes even more important to be able to understand, well, what's available to us on this fine day or on this cloudy, rainy day or whatever. It as we know, as the weather changes, the availability of these different types of energy is going to change with it.
We have Randy in Kadat next. Randy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on your program today.
Mm-hmm. What's on your mind?
Well, actually, I wanted to compliment your guest today on the subject matter and the idea of breaking up our electric grid into smaller components. And I would like to ask them what they thought about California shipping their electric energy to another state and then having it routed back into California and charging their customers more for the electric power that they originally generated and rebought back.
Yeah. That's one. I have no knowledge of that myself. Bob Lasseter, do you?
Well, I'm not sure I have direct knowledge, but the big picture is that the utilities are in a really tough spot because in California, they're encouraging a lot more solar being put in, wind being put in. But what that does is that kills their marketplace. If they don't sell that electricity, who pays for all the investment and capital obligations on that? And so what's really happening is utilities' business model is being threatened. And as you put more and more in, there will be less people to use their energy. And so their prices have to go up. And that's one that needs an enormous amount of thought, both politically and technically, how do you bring all this local source in, which is, in principle, more efficient and provides local reliability without putting utility out of business? Or another way of looking at it is if everybody that can afford this does it, who pays the utilities for their fundamental costs?
Yeah.
I think this is a good opportunity to bring in the fact that, you know, Bob and I are technologists, engineers. I mean, we work on proving the concept. But ultimately, for so many of these technologies, what they eventually evolve into depends far more on economics and, in this case, very much so on issues of regulation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a user, we tend to just take the electric grid for granted. You know, we flip the lights, we pay our bills, and we just expect it to be there. But when you look more closely, I mean, it's a very, very special kind of business. I mean, it's what we first refer to as a regulated utility because it is a special kind of monopoly in the sense that we don't have multiple electric lines coming into our house and we choose which one we want the power to come in on. And so the issue of how the government handles new technology, whether it be solar power or whether it be microgrids, is going to have a big impact on how the technology grows and what it evolves into.
We'll need to talk about this. We have to have you guys back to talk about this some more. We're completely out of time. Tom Johns, Bob Lasseter, thank you so much for being
Our
with
pleasure.
Us today.
And we enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll talk some more about microgrids down the road. Thank you all for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay listening.